Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org and scotthorton.org/interviews for the interviews, /show for the questions and answers stuff. You can ask me your questions at hashtag SHSQA on Twitter, SHSQA. And yeah, follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Introducing our friend Chris DeLiso. It's just like the old days, talking with Chris DeLiso again. Man, I missed you, Chris. The book is Migration, Terrorism, and the Future of a Divided Europe, A Continent Transformed. That's the new one. It's coming out this month.
Yeah, end of May.
End of May. Great. Migration, Terrorism, and the Future of a Divided Europe. All right. And then, of course, the website is balkanalysis.com. Yeah. I'm proud that I'm one of the few people who actually reads that URL carefully and pronounces it right. Balkanalysis. .com. That's what happens
indeed.
You combine two words together. They make a new
yes.
Bulk analysis. All right. The great Chris DeLiso, exclusive White House, NSC, neither knew nor approved of Ambassador Bailey's controversial decision in Macedonia. All right. Well, first tell me why Macedonia is important, Chris. Welcome back. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks very much. Since the last time we talked, I guess a month or two ago, we've had a continuing political crisis for over 3 years now, and this started with alleged wiretaps of government corruption and all that. And Macedonia is strategically situated on the corridor linking the Greek port of Thessaloniki to Central Europe. So there's this aspect of being on a strategic corridor. It also has a strategic neighborhood with the Balkans and, you know, potential Russian influence, Chinese influence, American influence, German influence, and the Albanian factor to the west, which has become the big issue of what is blocking or was supposed to be blocking until recently a new government formed by the losers of the election, who happen to be the socialists who are sponsored by George Soros. So we have quite the Balkan drama as usual. Every day something new. And the article that you refer to was published, last weekend, after a unprecedented storming of the parliament on Thursday evening by thousands of angry protesters after the opposition elected a speaker of parliament who was ethnic Albanian, although it was not particularly because of his ethnicity. It was just because they did this in a way that was against the procedure, and they hadn't denounced the platform of Tirana, which was the maximalist ethnic demands that was agreed in Edi Rama's office, who's the prime minister of neighboring Albania. So for 2 months we had protesters, peaceful protesters, who said if you try to elect a speaker of parliament without disavowing this platform, we will enter the parliament. So it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that eventually there would be some sort of a violent altercation, although different sides have blamed each other. We'll probably never know the full story of what happened and why. The only thing that's important about this is that it was a catalyst for massive foreign media coverage and sudden coordinated recognitions of the new speaker, Talat Jaferi, by the U.S., NATO, EU, OSCE, and so on. And so that was the catalyst that moved the process forward. Mm-hmm. And in that weekend,
let me stop you right there and make sure I understand what you're saying here. Saying the minority got the speaker somehow by hook or crook, the George Soros-backed socialist losers of the election who don't.
Yeah.
How do they control the parliament if they don't control the parliament? That's where I'm hung up.
Well, they had 49 MPs, members of parliament, elected in December. The Vimero, the conservative incumbents, had 51. Together with their traditional Albanian partner, DUI, they should have had 61, which would be mathematically enough for forming and a coalition, but there was heavy pressure allegedly put on to the Albanian party by the U.S. Embassy and others to not form this coalition. Instead, they mopped up a coalition with a bunch of other smaller ethnic Albanian parties so that they could push them over the top mathematically so that the socialists who they've been nurturing for the last 3 years would finally somehow win, even though they're not popular.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, I'm sorry, you use they and their a little bit much there. I wanted to make sure I understood which was which. You're saying the Albanians traditionally would have gone with the conservative majority, but American intervention pressured them to, you're saying, form a coalition with the other Albanian parties, and then all of them moved to the socialist side.
Well, almost like that. The sort of gentleman's agreement has usually been that whichever party wins the most votes among the Macedonian side will join with whatever party wins the most vote among the Albanian side.
So the tradition isn't that they would side with the right. It's that they would side with whoever's winning anyway without them, and then they just go.
Because it seemed like the legitimacy factor of the ethnic communities, and you know, things were okay. And so this time, for the first time, they broke that rule for the first time since 2006.
Because the USA, red, white, and blue, is insisting that the socialist get their speaker.
And this is why
it's
so weird. We're not even sure. This is why I wrote that article, because there's been a huge amount of interest since Donald Trump was elected about how this would change the State Department. I know the ambassador here was very nervous after Trump was elected that they would suddenly change the Obama, Clinton, Soros, move for the left. But because the State Department has been so neglected and understaffed, there's literally nobody there who's even aware. So what we saw was literally a group of four or five low-level State Department people and an ambassador deciding the course of the political transition in the country all by themselves. And that's why I wrote that article, not because I particularly care about any political party here, because in truth, this situation doesn't involve any Macedonians or Albanians. It's all a larger external issue. The main issue there was whether this recognition of the new speaker by the U.S. Embassy was legitimately reflecting the actual interests of the Trump administration. And what we found, and have still since found, because the guy who came, Hoi Yi, he didn't answer the question. He was extremely arrogant about the way he did not answer the question. We still have no idea who sent him, when. The announcement that he would come was made a day before the excitement in Parliament when they broke in. So this was clearly something was planned to move the process forward, and I understand they're going to bring some of the opposition leaders to Washington soon for a meet and greet. And this is all occurring at the same time, of course, as Judicial Watch has fired a lawsuit against the State Department and USAID, and that some senators and congressmen from the Republican side are investigating whether U.S. tax dollars were misspent supporting Soros and the left. So there's a huge context here. There's a lot at stake.
Right. And then and it really comes down to relations with NATO and the European Union, is that it?
It seems something like this, like they're trying to force them onto staying on the EU path, not that they were ever off it. And this is the strange thing, is that the conservative government had always been pro-NATO and pro-EU and pro-US, and it just boggles the mind how this interventionism is actually already backfiring, because as Macedonian leaders warned in January when they endorsed this Tirana platform, that if they do this with special rights, more special rights for minorities, then Russia could do this. And you know, just today or yesterday, a Russian official announced, well, we would like to have more rights for our people in the Baltics if this is going through. So they created the conditions where they've violated the rule of law, and it doesn't seem to matter to them, and they've created the ground conditions for a pure power struggle involving Russia or other countries, whereas China, wisely as always, has said absolutely nothing, and they just wait for their own commercial interests somewhere down the road. And once again, the U.S. is talking nonstop without knowing what it's saying.
All right, now what do you mean about special rights for the Albanian minority there?
These are the details of the platform, which are still somewhat debated, which would involve making it a second official language nationwide and in the large parts of the country where no Albanians live, which is not really a... I don't see why you would want that, even. It's not a good use of taxpayer money, and it's just not necessary. So you have a bunch of other minorities, including Turks, Roma, Serbs, Vlachs, and therefore their rights would not be equally represented either. So it's actually a reification of a binational division-oriented solution that they were trying to push. And the saddest thing about living here and watching this is seeing how the society has been divided, not necessarily inter-ethnically, but intra-ethnically. Within, you have, you know, friends on both sides who don't talk to each other for years because of the political divide. And it just seems to be increasing, this level of tension and alienation among the society. And this is going to be one of the biggest legacies of our interventionism here in the last few years.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now what all can you tell us about George Soros' role in all of this?
Well, he's been, since the early 90s, quite important. If you look, there's a New Yorker article from about 95 that details his projects here. And he has funded a lot of NGOs, and the NGOs mostly tend to side with the Social Democrats, and their personnel, their old guard personnel, are heavily involved with it. So it's an incestuous relationship. And then, you know, they've, since Obama times, they're having a strategic relationship with USAID. And now that the, Republicans are questioning this and actually making lawsuits and asking about Soros, now Soros's people are going on the attack. So anyone who has ever criticized him is likely to be, attacked in the media and so on. So it's another side aspect of this ridiculous interventionism that is spreading further and further every day.
All right, now, so I'm totally with the possibility of this stupidity theory at work here, where here's the Conservative Party that never was a problem anyway, that would have gone along with the larger EU and NATO agenda anyway. It would be like if the European Union freaked out that Donald Trump was elected because they were under the misimpression that he was going to undo the world order, when in fact, no, he's not, and he never was going to, kind of thing. But on the other hand, maybe it's just corruption. Maybe there are things that are, what we're really talking about is money, and that the people who get elected are going to do certain favors for certain connected people, and that that's the overriding interest, since the overall policy doesn't seem to be much different.
There is quite a lot of hidden interests and money, as well as you say. There's a lot of minerals in the Balkans that are yet untapped, and so there's a lot of people who might, like as we saw when Kosovo was liberated and so on, you had the Clinton administration people like Wesley Clark and Madeleine Albright, running in and making their own fortunes out of that. So there is possibly, but this is a much higher level thing where I'm not really investigating the economic aspects of it. There's a lot of people, but what we could see from the ethnic war of 2001 was where it started under very, very similar circumstances of a wiretap scandal followed by an ethnic conflict. Is the leaders of the main parties then, who were both accused of being corrupt, neither of them were ever put in jail. So while both of the talking points for both of the parties now are, this guy's afraid that he's going to be in jail, or that guy's afraid, probably none of them will be in jail. And they'll always find a way of accommodation, because this is a very small country where everybody knows each other. And it's also not a violent country. So there's always somehow a manner of accommodation that works itself out in the end. It's just a very specific place.
Well, yeah, I mean, hey, that's the good news then.
Well, one should hope.
I can't really tell from the map, but yeah, it looks like it's about the size of Travis County.
About the size of South Carolina.
About the size of South Carolina, okay. Well, that's a little bit bigger than Travis County, but okay.
Well, I can tell you, looking out the window, going down the street every day, there's absolutely no reason for any violence of any kind.
Yeah.
The people are not, out with guns. People don't hate each other. This is not, there's absolutely no reason for any problem. So if there are people who are trying to create problems, that's the problem.
Right. All right, so tell me more about this book, speaking of problems. it's a coincidence, I guess. But it seems like we have a massive refugee problem of people fleeing Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Iraq, and Syria. Not sure what American foreign policy has to do with any of those countries where people are trying to run away right now. There are also migrants coming from other places as well. But even then, seems like you could probably trace most of it to the economic devastation of America's terror wars this whole century long so far. But so now we're living in the consequences here deep into the future, 2017. I don't know how many millions of people have fled to Europe just in the teens. Maybe you can break it down. Help Americans understand what this migration crisis is like from the point of view of a European.
Well, it's started in earnest in early 2015, first on the sea route from Libya, because Gaddafi had been the guarantor of stability for Italy until he was killed. So after Gaddafi was killed, this opened the floodgates for the maritime route to Italy. And then the EU started to get involved and tried to shut it down a little, and then the route shifted over from Turkey to the Greek islands and up through Macedonia, and that was when we had the huge wave from the summer of 2015. And through a lot of bilateral diplomacy and work with the European Council, specifically European Council President Donald Tusk, the Macedonian authorities were able to shut down this, what they called the Balkan route, in March of last year. And to this day, it has been shut down, which has basically saved the European Union from itself. If this had not happened, I don't think that these politically, internally divided countries in Europe would function as the EU. So basically, Macedonia saved the EU. And this is what they get in exchange, is this kind of interference. Still, there's a possibility that the Turkish President Erdogan could send as many migrants as he wants in the future, and nobody would be able to stop him because, you know, he's got the people. And in the meantime, the sea route from Libya has started up again. And I believe the Italian authorities are launching an investigation into some NGOs associated with Soros that seem to be helping to bring these people into Europe. And my book goes into very great length about this, but it's basically, as I see, an industry of the future. Angela Merkel has talked before about, you know, an aging population, we need more workers and so on, but I think it goes much deeper than that. And if you look at the very top of the pyramid of the United Nations and the NGOs, it's this development migration complex of very few well-connected people at the very top who are making an awful lot of money out of this. So it's
the whole thing's a racket. Now, so in what way? They're the ones selling the life jackets or what?
The Chinese are the ones producing the life jackets anyway. But you have these multi-billion-dollar aid packages, and now they're combining with the private sector. So one of the last things that Obama did in September 2016, the new UN Secretary Guterres, actually is a former head of the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees. What they did was, with Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, other companies like this, talking about re-educating migrants and investing in migrant-related business, and George Soros offered $500 million for this. So this is a real global top of the ladder sort of new industry. It's developing.
Mm-hmm. And everybody involved gets a million off the top, basically, the Taylor and Panama
style. I think it's sort of the migration away from accountability on the national level, on the democratically elected government level, towards supranational institutions like the European Union and the United Nations. So everything that seems to be chaos, and when you have terrorist attacks and attacks, you know, against the right or against the left or who knows, it always seems to make the supranational structures stronger. Mm-hmm. And these are the people who, if you want to, as a journalist, if you want to get an interview, it's impossible. Or if you ask you know, a spokesman a simple question, they always refer you to someone else who refers you to someone else. So it's an increasingly closed-off world of decision-making that you or I will never really know about.
Mm-hmm. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
Yeah, well, there certainly is a lesson there. You know, people, for whatever reason, I'm not sure, this is a common dream that you'd have bigger and bigger supranational states, ultimately a global federal government, and yet, how, if we can't influence our local city council or county judges to obey us or leave us the hell alone at least, how could we ever hope to control organizations on that kind of level? As you're saying, they won't even answer your questions, much less
listen to you. No. So, and this is another reason why it's so important here, is because some people want to open the migrant route again through the Balkans and play off of the tensions that will cause. It's like, in some way, Europe is like a piggy bank, and it has a lot of money, and people want to shake it out, see what they can get. And there's a lot of private interests that develop. Like, one of the companies that I looked into was a Swiss private company worth several billion that had been invested into by American teachers unions and Saudi funds and others, and they were the ones providing, that they won the contracts providing shelters for migrants from the German, Austrian, Swiss governments. So you're getting to this level of globalization where everything is a commodity, whether it's the mafia or other people doing organ trafficking, whether it's the universities that are having new refugee studies departments and get huge grants from foreign countries. It's all becoming this, and I'm not saying something like one world government thing. I'm just saying they're making new industries out of migration. And if you look in Washington and New York and some of the places that the UN is working with the different NGOs and different universities, they have a very comprehensive plan for dealing with the migration crisis across the world. And again, this is a very small number of people.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't mean to say like, oh, there's some plan that's being implemented now to create a world government. But just as I was saying, it's kind of a common dream that, you know, like on Star Trek, eventually it must be or something like that. But how would anybody think that, you know, the further away a government gets from them, the more accountable it is? It just doesn't make
sense. Exactly.
But
and, you know, these people are megalomaniacs as well. They're people like Soros is a psychopath. There's no getting around it.
Yeah. Well, even the average millionaire has people kissing their ass all day and makes their head swell out of proportion to their actual value in the world. So somebody, you know, billionaires and European Union functionaries and whatever, I mean, these are the kinds of people who they have no reason to doubt themselves, you know, at all.
Yeah,
not that
they're
ever confronted with anyway.
They
always just fail
by
up.
Any of these crises that they start.
Right. All right, so now, and here's another thing that I think is really important here, is blaming Islam. Oh my God, look, everybody, 2015, this is the first day in the history of the world, and look at the horrible Muslim invasion. It's just like that time that the heroic Poles came and stopped them at the gates of Vienna, and you get to basically all the right-wingers and Islamophobes and warmongers get to indulge in all of their confirmation biases, when in fact what we're talking about is refugees from America's terror war that they all supported, that was waged in the name of bringing all of these countries into modernity so that they won't ever want to come here because they'll live in such great countries and they'll be so free and rich and prosperous like us. And these are the very same people who supported all of those wars who now want to close their eyes and pretend that the reason there are a bunch of Afghans in Germany right now is because Islam makes them try to conquer Germany rather than America raised Afghanistan to the ground 10 times over since the invasion in 2001. And it's either that or starve.
Yeah, there is something to that. But, I mean, there are Islamist leaders who do want to see a more Islamic Europe, that's for sure. But the average person, not so much. I don't know exactly what question that you want me to answer out of that.
I don't know, man. Well, go ahead. Tell us then about the role of Islam in all this. I mean, I know that when you wrote your book, The Coming Balkan Caliphate, you said, well, come on. I mean, that's the publisher's hyperbolic title there. The Islamists left over from the Bosnia War weren't that bad, you know, compared to how they could have been.
In that book, I did predict that there would be possibility for street warfare in Europe with terrorists, which is exactly what we saw in France.
Yeah.
I didn't predict that the whole Balkans would become occupied zone of Islam, which is not the case, but regarding the comment about terrorism, well, this is another thing that divides Islam. This is another thing that divides the internal political debate, and that's what's so important. Because when you divide the populations, it's easier to have weak governments. And so what we have seen is, and we see in France, we saw in Holland and other elections, the center, the traditional parties, the traditional two-party systems in different countries has fallen apart as you have more radical right and radical left parties, which, you know, let's be honest, they use Islam as a reason to fight each other. So you will see Greek anarchists who will be fighting against Greek right-wing groups, and they'll use the charge of racist or anti-Islamist to justify fighting each other because that's what they enjoy doing, because that's their thing.
Yeah.
But there is, again, there are some very sinister things going on, and I don't want to posit that I know, because I don't know. But one of my sources in the book noted, wasn't it interesting that a week after the terrorist attacks in France, the European Parliament was able to pass through this law on sharing of passenger data on airplanes,
mm-hmm.
and that this law had been stuck in committee for quite some time, maybe even years, due to civil liberties concerns. You know, if you can fly into a European airport, if they have to share all your data and so on,
mm-hmm.
Which was something probably the U.S. had wanted. And so as soon as that terrorist attack happened, that bill went through very quickly.
Ain't that always so the way? Yeah.
Well, one of the big things that I mentioned in the chapter is because these migrants were not vetted properly, you really have absolutely no idea who is in Europe. And this was one of the things that the Macedonian authorities found, that there was, you know, thousands of, at the height of it, there were thousands of people streaming across, and the Greeks simply didn't have time to process them all, and so nobody knew who they were.
Mm-hmm.
They could be ISIS members, they could be simple refugees, they could be any number of things. And in the same time, you have had migrants who are living, say, in Greece for 20 years, who are Afghans or Moroccans or Pakistanis, who used that wave of people as a chance to get into Central Europe. So now if you go in Austria, you can find a community of Afghans who speak perfect Greek, because they weren't actually, you know, forced out of their homes by the recent wars, but they had been living there and they saw this was a great opportunity to go.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, considering the, you know, talk of Greater Albania and all that, that one of the largest groups of alleged asylum seekers in 2015 was ethnic Albanians, and they were all returned as quickly as possible by Germans.
Hmm.
So it's a very complicated issue.
You know, it seemed to me for a long time, because again, the context here is the wars, the permanent state of war in all of these countries.
Yeah.
So just as you were predicting these kind of conflicts in the streets back in the last book, I mean, anybody could have seen this coming. And especially, geez, since NATO, including, of course, the U.S. and Israel and the GCC and Turkey, have been backing the Sunni-based insurgency led by al-Qaeda in Iraq, now known as the al-Nusra Front. And ISIS, although not that they're necessarily backing ISIS as much. Maybe some of our allies are. I don't know the Americans are. But ISIS is certainly a result of them backing al-Nusra and backing al-Nusra's war there in the first few years after the Arab Spring and hijacking the revolt there. And so Lord knows there's huge problems coming. But here's the thing that I'm getting to, and I actually have a point I want to ask you about here, is it seems to me like this can only go on so long without one or two things happening. Well, I don't even see it. It only looks like one thing to me, that hardcore right-wingers are going to win, are already winning, and are getting more right-wing, and they're going to keep winning across Europe. And then ultimately, they're going to be massive pogroms where, you know, not that they're going to be sent to death camps like in World War II, but they're going to be put on trains. The Muslims of Europe are going to be put on trains and sent to Turkey and removed by the millions at some point.
I don't know about that.
Because it seems to me like there's not much assimilation and integration going on here, and tensions are just getting higher and higher and higher.
Yeah, well, different countries have tried different schemes, like in Sweden or Norway, to give people money just to leave, voluntary repatriation. And I think that some of the countries have plans for that in the longer term. But what the rise in right-wing parties has actually done is it just forced the, let's say, mainstream milquetoast conservative governments like of Angela Merkel to go further to the right. But again, the problem is that she has a socialist as an ally, and that socialist is now Martin Schulz, formerly from the European Union Parliament, is coming back to run the party and run against her in the election. So they could have to make another coalition government in which the socialists had the upper hand and she was of less importance. So I don't see that their policy could actually change so dramatically. And the thing with we will see on Sunday with France, that will be really significant with what happens. But the elections so far haven't given populists a massive ability to enter. And as we saw with Donald Trump, even once elected, they don't seem to be able to carry out very much of what their agenda is. So if, say, Marine Le Pen was elected, I don't think she would actually be able to do half the things she says. Probably it's on the ground level within the neighborhoods, the people who are ethnically or religiously segregated can fight it out amongst each other. But government policies about, sending massive amounts of people on trains, I don't think they would do that because it's, there's still this European Union myth of peace and love and harmony and all that, which is basically created in the aftermath of World War II.
Okay, but how about after 10 more street fights in Paris and dead civilians all around? Because this is, again, with the Syria thing, as you said, they don't even know how many of these guys are hardened members of al-Nusra and ISIS who've now come in with the refugees.
Macron said, get used to it, right? He's the globalist candidate, former investment banker.
See, this is exactly what I mean. And I'm not saying necessarily Le Pen, and I'm not saying necessarily next year, but I'm just thinking, European civilization is not going to put up with this kind of insane policy. I mean, making this many refugees and creating this kind of crisis and letting that many in is one thing. But then turning around and backing al-Nusra and ISIS and helping these groups in the Syrian civil war for these last years grow to such size and have so many of them, even if we're only talking about tens, so many of them coming back into Europe. And these kind of attacks continuing to go on. And then this guy, Macron, if he really said that, then he's a dead duck. He's Hillary Clinton. If he says, well, just get used to it because, this is terrorism's a small price to pay for being America's lackeys. That's not going to fly, So I don't know. Give it a few years and a few more attacks, but it seems like it's coming to a head is all. I mean, I don't know. I've never even been to Europe. I don't know anything. I'm just saying.
Well, there's still a very powerful very powerful left-wing political correct dialogue here. And so, and especially with like groups like Facebook and Germany and the EU clamping down on hate speech and all of this, you have an underreporting of right-wing activity, I would say. Mm-hmm. And they go out of their way. And one of the Swedish police chiefs became a Facebook sensation by saying there's all these crimes by immigrants and I'm not allowed to report it. So I think it's very much a localized phenomenon, depending on within which country and even which part of which country is going to be beneficial for the local politicians. And in some areas in Germany, say there's ethnic Turks who are in charge of that area, and they will, you know, try to seek and destroy the right wing and vice versa. But the real, in the big issue, in the big picture, what is the EU's concern is West Africa. And this is where I was lucky enough to get a good interview with one of the operational leaders. For their prediction is that by 2050, the population of West Africa will double, and that this is the highest growing birth rate of any area in the world. And because of the, you know, Libya war, basically destroying any kind of barrier, you now have a renewed slave market, just like it was in the 18th and 19th centuries. And so they're expecting a large-scale influx of West Africans, and this is why they're setting up different programs, which is, they're basically trying to say, you know, we'll give you money if you don't come to these governments. But when they saw that Turkey received this offer of, what, $6 billion for not sending migrants, that was their deal about March 2016. Other countries like Egypt, which have a large capacity to send migrants, are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, the Europeans will give us money if we don't send migrants, so we can play this card. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see other countries on that end try to extort the EU for what they can get.
Right.
But, the EU also has increased its powers by, say, creating a coast guard. So they were able to use this crisis for their own advantage for the big military producers. Because if you're Europe and you're at peace, you don't really need to have big weaponry. So there's the one thing about increasing the military production is the alleged Russia threat, of course. But the other is the migrant threat. So this is where creating the European Coast Guard was helpful for some kinds of infrastructure and military producers in order to get more contracts and more money.
Yeah. Man, isn't that just the most amazing thing in the world? Barack Obama, the first openly black president, Calvin Coolidge, is actually not just the leader of the Libyan KKK, the Imperial Grand Wizard Dragon of their clan group there, responsible for all the pogroms and the Rosewood-style massacre in Tuerga and all of this. But now they literally have reinstituted the slave trade because of Barack Obama's war, private chattel slavery, because of Barack Obama's Libya war. Unbelievable.
Exactly.
Just, God dang. And there's just... Not forget accountability. Nobody even ever says that except you just now and then me parroting it back to you. Jesus Christ. You know?
But that's what you get when you get with larger and larger institutions and you have loss of state sovereignty. Is they just look at it as pieces of territory and, you know, counting statistics of people. When you read the UN sheets, they'll say this many million migrants did this and we need this much money. And it's all just a business, really.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, man, I should let you go before this thing runs too long. But thank you so much for coming back on the show, Chris. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
All right, y'all. That's the great Chris DeLiso. He's at balkanalysis.com. And this one is about, NSC. The White House and the NSC neither knew nor approved of Ambassador Bailey's controversial decision in Macedonia. Balkanalysis.com. And the book comes out at the end of this month, Migration, Terrorism, and the Future of a Divided Europe. And you can actually find out about that at abc-clio.com. And that's Scott Horton's show. Check me out at scotthorton.org/interviews/show for the questions and answers stuff. And follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.